The Guardian.
Welcome to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland.
After four long, tense days, we've reached a historic moment in this election.
Good morning. We have breaking news results from the state of Pennsylvania.
And it's 20 electoral votes.
Putting him over the 270 electoral votes he needs to become the 46th president of the United States.
Well, nearly 6 days after the American TV networks called it for Joe Biden, declaring that he had won the 2020 election and would be the 46th president of the United States, we still have a slight problem. The current president, Donald Trump, is hunkered down and digging in, refusing to concede defeat. He's claiming the opposite, that he won by a lot, and the only widespread fraud and the counting of illegal votes has put his opponent in front. The thing is, it's not even like this election was close. It wasn't. Last time I checked, Biden is just a little shy of 77 million votes in the popular vote count, and his lead over Donald Trump has stretched to 5 million and may get bigger. Hillary Clinton's final tally, remember, in 2016 gave her a lead of 2.8 million. Now, of course, we all know, especially if you've been listening to this podcast, that US elections do not hinge on the popular vote. It's all about the margin in the Electoral College. And as things stand, Joe Biden clears the bar there as well, and comfortably. You remember, you have to get 270 electoral votes to win. He's on course for 306. Same number, incidentally, as Donald Trump got 4 years ago. So I say again, this isn't even close. All of which means there's no question about it. Trump lost. He was defeated. He was beaten. But instead of accepting reality, he insists that a conspiracy of Democrats and the media and election officials have stolen the election from him. Any truth in that? Well, I have to say, I did like the headline in the New York Times that said simply, "The Times called officials in every state. No evidence of voter fraud." But here's the thing. Senior Republicans are not telling Donald Trump to get over it, face facts, and prepare to leave office. They're indulging this wholly debunked conspiracy theory, maybe to humour him, maybe to keep in with his supporters. Now, is all this a joke, a temper tantrum by a sore loser, which we can easily dismiss? Or are there grounds for concern here, starting with the fact that Trump has cleared out the top officials from the Defense Department, replacing them with loyalists? It prompts a question. What exactly is Donald Trump up to? To try and answer that, I'm joined by my old friend, the Guardian US columnist, Richard Wolff. Richard, before we plunge into all of this mire, I do want to know how you took in the result when it finally came. Where were you when you finally got the news? And how did you feel?
Well, I was at home here in Manhattan, clicking through all of the Secretary of State election websites, looking at the vote tallies. My calculation, based on all of my conversations with political campaign friends here, was that we all expected a higher threshold for votes in Pennsylvania before the networks would call it. And it took me by surprise that they called it when they did, a little bit earlier than the vote counts. And frankly, as I was sort of telling my family about this news finally breaking, the streets erupted in, cars tooting their horns and people cheering in the streets. Harlem is a place where lots of people like to make noise at all times, but especially on that Saturday morning.
People had really, even here thousands of miles away, had been on tenterhooks. I mean, really, almost random people in the street saying, when are we going to hear? Yeah. When is this finally going to be resolved? And when the moment came, the phone started buzzing and just this palpable sigh, almost scream of relief felt around.
I have to say, New York was partying well into Sunday. Obviously, people were gripped by the drama of it and desperate for a resolution. But it also speaks to the seemingly unending stress and anxiety of the last 4 years, and how much so many people's fates hangs in the balance with this decision of a single country's leader. And I don't think that is just about the drama of the news story. It genuinely does affect the trajectory of so much of the policies we all care about.
But we haven't heard much or seen much, really, of supporters of Donald Trump. They certainly, I don't think, have been taken to the streets, obviously, in celebration, but not even the opposite. Is that because they're just in stunned despair because of losing? Or is it that they are taking their lead from the man at the top and believe it genuinely is not over?
Oh, well, that's a fascinating question, because we're getting into the sort of psychosis, the Trump-induced psychosis among his hardcore fans. We can expect to see some demonstrations on Saturday in DC when there is supposed to be what they're calling a million MAGA march. I think civil rights leaders may be throwing up a little in their mouths at that. But
because, of course, it was a reference there to the Million Man March, which was the event for African Americans. And MAGA, the acronym for Make America Great Again, the shorthand for Trump and his movement.
Thank you for explaining that. But that's right. We don't know. I mean, there have been supposed mass events like Trump's rally in Tulsa, where a million people were supposed to show up and actually only a few thousand did. So we'll see. In terms of the numbers, though, there are some conflicting polls. 79%, according to a Reuters poll, are convinced that Biden won the election. That now gives us, I think, the long sought after baseline of what is the hardcore? What percentage of Americans will go to their graves swearing loyalty and fealty to Donald Trump? It's 21%. They are consuming vast amounts of information and disinformation about Trump's position on Facebook, on weird news channels that are trying to emerge as rivals to Fox News, like Newsmax and One America News, which Trump endlessly promotes. And so they can live in a delusional bubble as long as they like. But reality is coming soon. The votes get certified in the states and the Electoral College meets. So, you know, the clock is ticking and it's inexorable.
What about Republican leaders, particularly in Congress and on Capitol Hill? I think it's fair to say that you and me and most other observers never did expect a gracious concession speech from Donald Trump. We talked about it on this podcast. I think we knew that he would reject this outcome. The question was always a bit about how senior Republicans, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, and others, whether they would indulge this or whether they would sing a different tune. What have we seen so far, and do you think it's more or less in line with expectations?
No, I don't think it's in line with expectations. Look, if you're discounting the polls, I would always discount Donald Trump's behavior. So we never expected him to do the right thing. However, just a few weeks before the election, Republican leaders, especially senators, all paraded out when Donald Trump said, questioned whether he would accept the results and there would be a peaceful transition of power. They came out pretty much en masse to say, of course, there will be a peaceful transition of power. The results will be respected and we will move on. And that's actually not what's happened. The thinking is, well, you know, that the Republicans need to keep people engaged. They need these Trump voters and Trump fans to be with them so they can't possibly break with Trump. Trumpism is here to stay. And that's a profoundly depressing thought for anyone who cares about the sort of state of political health in this country and elsewhere, frankly.
Yeah, we should bring people up to speed with quite how bad this has been. I mean, we had the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration.
And people could debate whether or not he was joking or not, but saying we're going to have a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, saying
the president has every right to look into allegations and to request recounts under the law.
On its face, true, but not saying, but, you know, the obvious, which is so far the votes indicate that Joe Biden will be president-elect. And in Texas, the lieutenant governor there, Dan Patrick, offering up to $1 million for anyone to come forward with evidence of voter fraud, which I thought was sort of revealing because on the one hand, it says like, yeah, I'm backing Donald Trump. On the other hand, if you're asking for evidence, right, it suggests that you haven't really got any. And this is the problem, is that they keep claiming it. And yet around the country, quite quietly, there are court cases going ahead state by state, which are more or less just being thrown out because you have to have actual evidence and they don't. What are they really waiting for? I mean, is there a moment that they're waiting for someone else, in effect, to decide this for them so that Pompeo and McConnell and the others never have to be the ones to break it to the supporters? They never have to be the ones to say whether Santa Claus is real or not. Are they hoping someone else will do this difficult job of telling people that, you know, the dream is over?
I think to corrupt entirely the Kennedy-esque book title, these are profiles in cowardice. There's no plan here. There's been a constant debate around Trump about, as I think it was Peter Thiel, the tech investor, put it, about whether, you know, you take him literally or you take him seriously, and people confusing the two. With regard to Pompeo, the question of was he joking or not, it is almost neither here nor there. You should know that the traditional form of communication between world leaders and president-elects go through the State Department. That's the secure line of communication, the established one. And Pompeo's State Department, because of this refusal to accept the results of the election, is actually hoarding the messages that have come in from world leaders for Joe Biden. There's a massive challenge to the transition. It's surmountable, but it's petty and vindictive and utterly futile. I mean, you should read some of the transcripts from the judges. I mean, they're utterly humiliating for the Trump lawyers when the judges question them. Do you have any evidence? No, I don't.
I mean, there are moments of absolute pure comedy, aren't there? My favorite one is, this was earlier, but, you know, are there observers there? And the Republican lawyer answers, there is a non-zero number, meaning, yes, there are observers and I've got no case here.
There's a review of some of the transcripts of what the election observers, the Trump election observers, are complaining about. And it's things like, someone seemed rude. Someone told me to go back to the suburbs. And you should know that in those election counts, there was also, sadly, but typically, a racial dynamics to this, where white suburban Trump observers were hectoring African-American poll workers. And so that was also playing out in this. And that's clearly a sort of thread to some of these transcripts. But, you know, these cases will fall apart. They are falling apart. They are being dismissed out of hand. There's no case for taking anything to the Supreme Court. The last gasp is to say, well, state legislatures can certify their own slate of electors to go to the Electoral College and ignore the popular vote. That's also not true. That's not legal either. In a place like Pennsylvania, which really is the deciding state in terms of getting Joe Biden to 270 Electoral College votes, the law quite clearly states that the electors in the Electoral College will be decided by the popular vote, and there's nothing the Republican-controlled state legislature in Pennsylvania can do about it. So that's a pipe dream too. This thing doesn't make any sense. And if you are trying to go beyond the base, beyond the 20-25% of diehard Trump fans, how do you speak to suburban voters who are peeling away? How do you tell them that, you know, you have a position that makes any sense? I think it's a profound challenge to the Republican Party now and moving forward.
President Donald Trump terminating Defense Secretary Mark Esper in his first major act since losing the election. Trump announcing.
Let's then move to these firings, because they go to an important question of what Trump exactly is up to. Either it's a psychological tactic and he just can't bear the idea he's lost. That's one reading. There's another reading that says he is preparing the ground for his next career, which is perhaps to have a conservative media company, a rival to Fox, Trump TV. And the base for that, the audience for that, you need them to have this unity, to be united around a grievance. And the grievance will be, you know, we were stabbed in the back. An election was stolen from us. And so he's forming already the premise for his new media organization, and maybe even for another run at the presidency. The third view is that, no, he's serious. He really does not plan to leave power, to leave office. And that's the context, runs this theory, in which we should see these firings. He's sacked a whole echelon of civilian leadership at the Department of Defense, at the Pentagon, and that gets people concerned that maybe, is he thinking of something else here? Is he about to ask the military to do something which he knew the previous lot would refuse to do, and that's why he wants loyalists there, perhaps to obey this command? Am I getting, you know, over feverish here, me and all the other people who are raising this, or is there grounds for concern here, Richard?
Well, with Trump, there are always grounds for concern. I mean, it is hard. I am always drawn at these times to an interview I did with an early Trump biographer. This was before he became president, who was describing what Trump's behavior was like on the day that he had the fire sale of his bankrupt casinos in New Jersey, in Atlantic City. And the biographer told me that you'd never know that his business, you'd never have known on the day that his businesses were going under. He was determined to say this was the best deal anyone could buy, and that even though things were obviously bankrupt, it was a great deal, and he was exuding confidence and positivity and pretending like there are great things ahead, and you obviously can see that in his Twitter feed. There is one motive for Donald Trump, apart from his own ego, and that's to make money. And I think that, for a start, that there's no option for him to sort of cross his legs on the floor of the Oval Office and be dragged out. That's not going to happen. However, there are things of value that he can exploit that may have financial value for him over the next couple of months in this transition. So he's not interested in dealing with a pandemic or a transition or his legacy or any of those normal measures. There's a value in intelligence. So one of the big fears here is in all of these moves at the Department of Defense and the National Security Agency that he may declassify information that will either make him look good or maybe of value to foreign players and commercial interests who would find that stuff worth something. We should never underestimate Trump's desire to make money and to bolster not just his brand, but his financial security.
And he has indeed put this loyalist in at the most secret of all the secret agencies, the National Security Agency, the NSA. But what about at the top level, getting rid of Secretary of Defense Mark Esper and the various figures underneath that? How do we explain that? I understand your point about making money and also the point people have made about leverage. So he creates a huge fuss now so that he actually gives Joe Biden an incentive to just make him go away quietly. And therefore, who knows what kind of deals may be done with Joe Biden. I find that plausible. But I still can't. The piece of the puzzle that is nagging at me and worrying me a bit is this change in civilian leadership at the Pentagon. Because what would you have in your mind if you're doing that?
The people we're talking about and the positions we're talking about, you know, you couldn't pick out of a lineup. You couldn't even come up with the correct titles that we're talking about unless you thoroughly Googled them. So these are pretty obscure people in obscure positions. This isn't about controlling the news cycle. And by the way, it is extremely unusual to have these kinds of personnel changes at this point. Sometimes you get late breaking ambassador news because someone wants to have a donor, wants to have the title of ambassador forevermore at this point. But that's not what this is about. The people he has installed in these positions are former aides to people like Devin Nunes, who is a House Republican, who used to lead up the Intelligence Committee and did his utmost to protect Trump from the Russia investigation and undermine the Mueller report and the FBI. The other group of people who are getting boosted here are former aides to Michael Flynn.
Here's the statement that Flynn gave, or part of the statement that Flynn gave in his resignation letter. He said, "Unfortunately, because of the fast pace of events, I inadvertently briefed the vice president-elect and others with incomplete information regarding my phone calls with the Russian ambassador."
Trump's first national security advisor and national security advisor in the transition, the Trump transition, in 2016, when he famously had lots of back channels with the Russians, which he lied about and pled guilty to and was convicted for that. So a suspiciously cooperative group of Russian friends in these extremely sensitive positions. One of the defense positions is in charge of the massive intelligence budget that sits within the Pentagon. The Defense Intelligence Agency is actually better funded and bigger than the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. So these are not small or inconsequential positions. They are deeply troubling, and they suggest that there is a pattern here that, who knows, maybe Trump isn't even aware of, but someone is aware of, because it is extremely strange to be doing this right now. And if there's an innocent explanation for it, it's not apparent.
And just before we leave this topic, the media, crucial players in all this. I know the mainstream news organizations are calling Joe Biden president-elect and all that. But the interesting thing is the sort of pro-Trump media. And we were all here, I think, struck by the sight of Fox News pulling away from a White House press conference.
And we want every illegal vote to
I just think we have to be very clear. She's charging the other side is welcoming fraud and welcoming illegal voting. Unless she has more details to back that up, I can't in good countenance continue showing you this. I want to make sure.
And the New York Post, which is just both of these organizations owned by Rupert Murdoch, the New York Post flipping to a position of saying, you know, you're a loser and wake up and smell the coffee. Is that going to be significant?
Well, I think the Murdoch media, because you can pull in the Wall Street Journal in this, the Murdoch media is going through one of these interesting transitions where, you know, for credibility's sake, they want to elevate the roles of the sort of truth tellers and the, you know, there are some respectable journalists there who are reporting the facts. So those voices are elevated, but at the same time, they are also spewing out all sorts of falsehoods about, you know, it's all cooked up and fraud and everything else. So there's this conflict going on that probably reflects the debate within the Trump voting base. As we said, 25% of the population believes that it was all stolen, and then you've got another 20-odd% that actually has accepted reality or at least acknowledged it. And so that is playing out. You know, the question, I think, for particularly people at Fox News, which is really the cash driver of enormous profits, $1 billion or more each year in profits, the challenge for them is the emergence of other, even more delusional right-wing news outlets. I know there's a debate in the UK right now about having opinion-driven broadcasters coming on the scene very shortly. And, you know, look at what's happening here, where Fox News is pretty rapidly going to be seen as the reasonable player in delusional right-wing media compared to things like Newsmax, which may become branded as a Trump channel, or Trump may set up his own. I mean, you know, there's always a further extreme out there in this age of disinformation.
The Supreme Court today hearing oral arguments on the future of Obamacare. Insurance coverage for millions of Americans could hinge on this decision.
We do like on this program asking a what else question. And I thought we should ask you about Obamacare, which incredibly, given all that's going on, is grinding its way through yet again the Supreme Court. This is previous President Barack Obama's effort to reform healthcare, make more people covered and so on. It's back in the Supreme Court, not for the first time. What's happening there?
Yeah, well, this is an attempt, yet another attempt by Republicans to wipe out the whole law. They already had some success in taking out the penalties that were applied, fairly minimal penalties, but penalties nonetheless. Obamacare's principle, based actually on Mitt Romney's plan in Massachusetts, was to have a fine, a tax fee, for people who didn't sign up. That bit got struck out, and the Republican lawyers went to the Supreme Court saying, well, if you struck out that bit, the individual mandate, as they call it, you should strike out the whole law. It seems, as far as we can read from the tea leaves of the questioning of the Supreme Court justices, that they're not actually amenable to that argument.
It's not clear how the court will vote on the mandate, but today at least five justices, a majority, indicated the rest of the law should be left intact.
It feels, we don't actually know, that the Supreme Court, even a conservative-leaning one, will uphold Obamacare and not strike the whole thing down. That does allow President-elect Biden, the Biden administration, to continue to reform and amend and adapt that. But of course, that's not really what Biden promised. And this is where control of the Senate really does matter. Government-run healthcare, if it's going to be expanded, really does need a Democratic majority, even a slender one, in the U.S. Senate in January. If that doesn't happen, we'll still be tinkering around the edges of Obamacare for the next 4 years. It does suggest that, you know, Obama really bet his first term on healthcare reform, and it has proved enduring. And that's exactly what Republicans fear, that once you start a program like this, it's really impossible to kill it. And, you know, we're talking about presidential legacies. This undoubtedly will be one of those legacies. 20 million people added to healthcare because of President Obama. You can do what you like to executive orders, but legislation really does last.
Richard Wolff, as always, so good to talk with you. Thanks for joining me on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, for anyone wanting a slightly unexpected and different take on the election and what we should learn from it, listen back to yesterday's episode of our sister podcast, Today in Focus, where Michael Safi talks to two friends, both called Karen, on different sides of the political aisle. Do not miss that conversation. And of course, back in the UK, Brexit continues to rumble on. So do listen in to Wednesday's episode of Politics Weekly when Heather Stewart gives us the latest. But that is all from me for this week. The producer is Danielle Stevens, and I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please look after yourselves, and as always, thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.